Chapter 3 on Monarchy, Democracy, Public Opinion, and Delegitimation. 1. It is appropriate to begin with a few observations on Ludwig von Mises and his idea of a free society. The program of liberalism, wrote Mises, if condensed into a single word, would have to read property, that is, private ownership of the means of production. For in regard to commodities ready for consumption, private property is a matter of course and is not disputed even by the socialists and communists. All the other demands of liberalism result from this fundamental demand. Based on private property, Mises explained, the emergence of society, human cooperation, was the result of the natural diversity of people and property and the recognition that work performed under division of labor is more productive than work performed in self-sufficient isolation. He explained, if and as far as labor under the division of labor is more productive than isolated labor, and if and as far as man is able to realize this fact, human action itself tends toward cooperation and association. Experience teaches that this condition, higher productivity achieved under division of labor, is present because it's caused the inborn inequality of men and the inequality in the geographical distribution of the natural factors of production is real. Thus, we are in a position to comprehend the course of social evolution. End quote. If the emergence of society, human cooperation, under division of labor can be explained as the result of self-interested action, it is also true that, mankind being what it is, murderers, robbers, thieves, thugs, and con artists will always exist, and life in society will be intolerable unless they are threatened with physical punishment. The liberal understands quite well, wrote Mises, that without resort to compulsion, the existence of society would be endangered, and that behind the rules of conduct whose observance is necessary to assure peaceful human cooperation must stand the threat of force if the whole edifice of society is not to be continually at the mercy of any one of its members. One must be in a position to compel the person who will not respect the lives, health, personal freedom, or private property of others to acquiesce in the rules of life in society. This is a function that the liberal doctrine assigns to the state, the protection of property, liberty, and peace. End quote. If this is accepted, how is a government to be organized so as to assure that it will in fact do what it is supposed to do, protect pre-existing private property rights? In view of what I shall say later on in favor of the institution of monarchy, Mises's liberal opposition to the ancien regime of absolute kings and princes is worth noting here. Kings and princes were privileged personae. Almost by definition, they stood opposed to the liberal idea of the unity and universality of law. Thus, Mises stated, the liberal theory of the state is hostile to princes. He writes, the princely state has no natural boundaries. To be an increaser of his family estate is the ideal of the prince. He strives to leave his successor more land than he inherited from his father. To keep on acquiring new possessions until one encounters an equally strong or stronger adversary, that is the striving of kings. Princes regard countries no differently from the way in a state owner regards his forests, meadows, and fields. They sell them, they exchange them, for instance, rounding off boundaries, and each time rule over the inhabitants is transferred also. Lands and peoples are, in the eyes of princes, nothing but objects of princely ownership. The former form the basis of sovereignty, the latter the appurtenances of land ownership. From the people who live in his land, the prince demands obedience and loyalty. He regards them almost as his property. Further, Mises notes, the princely state strives restlessly for expansion of its territory and for increase in the number of its subjects. On the one hand, it aims at the acquisition of land and fosters immigration. On the other hand, it sets the strictest penalties against emigration. The more land, the more subjects, the more revenue, and the more soldiers. Only in the size of the state does assurance of its preservation lie. Smaller states are always in danger of being swallowed up by larger ones. As Mises rejected a princely state as incompatible with the protection of private property rights, what was to be substituted for it? His answer was democracy and democratic government. However, Mises's definition of democratic government is fundamentally different from its colloquial meaning. Mises grew up in a multinational state and was painfully aware of the anti-liberal results of majority rule in ethnically mixed territories. In polyglot territories, Mises writes, the application of the majority principle leads not to the freedom of all, but to the rule of the majority over the minority. Majority rule signifies for a part of the people, not popular rule, but foreign rule. Under the special circumstances of Habsburg, Austria as a multinational and yet fundamentally German state, the application of majoritarian principles would not only promote the dissolution of the empire. In particular, whether the empire was dissolved or not, democracy would systematically work against the Germans and ultimately lead to German national suicide. This, according to Mises, was the tragic position of the German liberals in Austria. Democratization in Austria was identical with the de-Germanization. Rather than majority rule, to Mises democracy meant literally self-determination, self-government, self-rule. And accordingly, a democratic government was an essentially voluntary membership organization in that it recognized each of its constituents' unrestricted right to secession. Liberalism, explained Mises, forces no one against his will into the structure of the state. Whoever wants to emigrate is not held back. When a part of the people of a state wants to drop out of the Union, liberalism does not hinder it from doing so. Colonies that want to become independent need only do so. The nation as an organic entity can neither be increased nor reduced by changes in states. The world as a whole can neither win nor lose from them. The right of self-determination in regard to the question of membership in a state thus means, whenever the inhabitants of a particular territory, whether it be a single village, a whole district, or a series of adjacent districts, make it known by a freely conducted plebiscite that they no longer wish to remain united to the state to which they belong at the time, their wishes are to be respected and complied with. This is the only feasible and effective way of preventing revolutions and international wars. If it were in any way possible to grant this right of self-determination to every individual person, it would have to be done. The objections Mises has against unlimited secession are solely technical in nature, economies of scale, etc. Thus, for instance, Mises admits having difficulties imagining in a nationally mixed city to create two police forces, perhaps a German and a Czech, each of which could take action only against members of its own nationality. On the other hand, Mises notes that the political ideas of modern times allow the continued existence of small states more secure today than in earlier centuries. There can be no question of a test of economic self-sufficiency in the formation of states at a time when the division of labor embraces broad stretches of land, whole continents, indeed, the whole world. It does not matter whether the inhabitants of a state meet their needs directly or indirectly by production at home. What is important is only that they can meet them at all. Even at the time when the state structure was unified, they, seceding inhabitants, did not obtain their imported goods for nothing, but only for value supplied in return, and this value in return does not become greater when the political community has fallen apart. The size of a state's territory, therefore, does not matter. Hence, Mises's answer as to how to assure that a government will protect property rights is through the threat of unlimited secession and its own characteristic of voluntary membership. 2. I do not wish to further investigate Mises's idea of democratic government here, but to turn instead to the modern definition of democracy and the question of its compatibility with the foundation of liberalism, that of private property and its protection. It might be argued that Mises's definition of democratic government was applicable to the United States until 1861. Until then, it was generally held that the right to secession existed and that the Union was nothing but a voluntary association of independent states. However, after the crushing defeat and devastation of the secessionist Confederacy by Lincoln and the Union, it was clear that the right to secede no longer existed, and that democracy meant absolute and unlimited majority rule. Nor does it appear that any state since that time has met Mises' definition of democratic government. Instead, like their American model, all modern democracies are compulsory membership organizations. It is all the more surprising that Mises never subjected this modern model of democracy to the same systematic analysis that he had applied to princely government. To be sure, no one has been more far-sighted regarding the destructive effects of modern government's social and economic policies than Mises, and no one has recognized more clearly the dramatic increase of state power in the course of the 20th century, but Mises never connected these phenomena systematically with modern compulsory democracy. Nowhere did he suggest that the decline of liberalism and the dominance of anti-capitalist political ideologies in this century of socialism, social democracy, democratic capitalism, social market economics, or whatever other label has been attached to various anti-liberal programs and policies, finds its systematic explanation in majoritarian democracy itself. What I propose to do here is to fill in the gap left by Mises and provide an analysis of the logic of majoritarian democracy, thereby making modern history, our age, intelligible and predictable. 3. Without the right to secession, a democratic government is, economically speaking, a compulsory territorial monopolist of protection and ultimate decision-making jurisdiction, and is in this respect indistinguishable from princely government. Just as princes did not allow secession, so it is outlawed under democracy. Furthermore, as implied in the position of a compulsory monopolist, both democratic government as well as princes possess the right to tax. That is, both are permitted to determine unilaterally, without consent of the protected, the sum that the protected must pay for their own protection. From this common classification as compulsory monopolies, a fundamental similarity of both princely and democratic government can be deduced. Under monopolistic auspices, the price of justice and protection will continually rise, and the quantity and quality of justice and protection fall. Qua expropriating property protector, a tax-funded protection agency is a contradiction in terms and will inevitably lead to more taxes and less protection, even if, as liberals advocate, a government limited its activities exclusively to the protection of pre-existing property rights, the further question of how much protection to produce arises. Motivated, as everyone is, by self-interest and the disutility of labor, but with the unique power to tax, a government agent's response will invariably be the same: to maximize expenditures on protection, and conceivably almost all of a nation's wealth can be consumed by the cost of protection, and at the same time to minimize the actual production of protection. The more money one can spend, and the less one must work to produce, the better off one will be. Moreover, a monopoly of jurisdiction will inevitably lead to a steady deterioration in the quality of protection. If one can appeal exclusively to government for justice, justice will be distorted in favor of government, constitutions, and appeals courts notwithstanding. Constitutions and appeals courts are government constitutions and agencies, and any limitations on government action they might provide are invariably decided by agents of one and the same institution. Predictably, the definition of property and protection will continually be altered, and the range of jurisdiction expanded to the government's advantage. 4. While they are both inconsistent with the protection of life and property, princely and democratic government are also different in one fundamental respect. The decisive difference lies in the fact that entry into a princely government is systematically restricted by the prince's personal discretion, while under democracy entry into and participation in government is open to everyone on equal terms. Anyone, not just a hereditary class of nobles, is permitted to become a government official and exercise any government function all the way up to that of prime minister or president. Typically, this distinction between restricted versus free entry into government and the transition from princely to democratic government has been interpreted as an advance toward liberalism, from a society of status and privilege to one of equality before the law. But this interpretation rests on a fundamental misunderstanding. From a classical liberal point of view, democratic government must be considered worse than a regression from princely government. Free and equal entry into government democratic equality is something entirely different from and incompatible with the classical liberal concept of one universal law, equally applicable to everyone, everywhere, and at all times. Liberalism, Mises noted, strives for the greatest possible unification of law in the last analysis for world unity of law. However, free entry into government does not accomplish this goal. To the contrary, the objectionable inequality of the higher law of princes versus the subordinate law of ordinary subjects is preserved under democracy in the separation of public versus private law and the supremacy of the former over the latter. Under democracy, everyone is equal insofar as entry into government is open to all on the same terms. In a democracy, no personal privileges or privileged persons exist. However, functional privileges and privileged functions exist. As long as they act in an official capacity, democratic government agents are governed and protected by public law and thereby occupy a privileged position vis-à-vis persons acting under the mere authority of private law, most fundamentally in being permitted to support their own activities by taxes imposed on private law subjects. Privileges, discrimination, and protectionism do not disappear. To the contrary, rather than being restricted to princes and nobles, privileges, discrimination, and protectionism can be exercised by and accorded to everyone. Predictably, under democratic conditions, the tendency of every compulsory monopoly to increase prices and decrease quality is strengthened. As a hereditary monopolist, a prince regards the territory and people under his jurisdiction as his personal property and engages in a monopolistic exploitation of his property. Under democracy, exploitation does not disappear. Even though everyone is permitted to enter government, this does not eliminate the distinction between the rulers and the ruled. Government and the governed are not one and the same person. Instead of a prince who considers the country his private property, a temporary and interchangeable caretaker is put in monopolistic charge. The caretaker does not own the country, but as long as he is in office, he is permitted to use it to his and his protege's advantage. He owns its current use, usufruct, but not its capital stock. This does not eliminate exploitation. Rather, it makes exploitation less calculating and carried out with little or no regard to the capital stock. In other words, it is short-sighted. Both hereditary princes and democratic caretakers can increase their current spending by means of higher taxes. However, a prince tends to avoid increasing taxes if this leads to capital consumption, a drop in the present discounted value of the capital stock of which he is the owner. In contrast, a caretaker shows no such reluctance. While he owns the present tax revenue, he does not own the capital stock from which it is derived. Others do. Accordingly, under democratic conditions, taxation increases far beyond its level under princely rule. In addition, both princes and caretakers can increase their current spending by means of debt, and endowed with the powers to tax, both tend to incur more debt than would private citizens. However, whereas a prince assumes a liability against his personal property whenever he borrows from, sells bonds to the non-government public, hence the present value of his property falls, a democratic caretaker is free of any such consideration. He can enjoy all the benefits of higher current spending while the liability and current drop in property values falls upon others. Accordingly, government debt is higher and increases faster under democratic conditions than under princely rule. Finally, both princes and caretakers can use their compulsory monopoly power to gain control over the money supply, so both can also increase their own present spending by inflating the supply of money. However, a prince who inflates the money supply will weigh two factors, his immediate enrichment and the fact that, as the inevitable result of a larger money supply, the future purchasing power of money and of his own future taxes will be lower. Unlike a prince, a democratic caretaker is concerned only with his immediate enrichment, for he does not own current and future tax revenues. He only owns the present tax revenue, so he is solely concerned with the present purchasing power of money. By increasing the money supply, he can increase his present purchasing power, while the attendant lower purchasing power of money and tax receipts must be borne in the future by others. Accordingly, money inflation will also be more prevalent under democratic conditions than under princely rule. 5. Moreover, with free entry into and participation in government, the perversion of justice and protection, law and order, will proceed even faster. The notion of universal and immutable human rights, and in particular of property rights, essentially disappears and is replaced by that of law as government-made legislation and rights as government-given grants. Rather than just redistributing income and wealth from civil society onto government by means of taxation, deficit financing and money inflation, both hereditary princes and democratic caretakers can also use their monopoly of jurisdiction for the redistribution of income and wealth within civil society. The incentives faced in this regard by princes and caretakers are distinctly different, however. It is instructive to take another look at princely government. As regards redistribution, princes face two disincentives. The first is a logical one. Even though a prince ranks above everyone else, his rights, too, are private rights, albeit of a somewhat elevated kind. If a prince takes the property of one person and distributes it to another, he undermines the principle on which his own position and security vis-à-vis other princes rests. Second, from an economic point of view, all general income and wealth redistribution from the haves of something to the have-nots is counterproductive and reduces the overall value of the territory. This is not to say that princes abstain from redistributive policies entirely, but their policies take a distinctly different form. On the one hand, they must appear in accordance with the idea of private property right. On the other, they should increase future productivity and hence the country's present value. Accordingly, princes typically grant personal rather than group privileges. They award privileges to haves instead of have-nots, and they attend to so-called social problems by reallocating labor cultivation, acculturation, and colonization policies rather than redistributing income and wealth. In contrast, a democratic caretaker faces no logical obstacle to the redistribution of private property. Rather than involving himself with the preservation and improvement of capital values, he will be concerned primarily with the protection and advancement of his own position against the competition of new government entrants. This type of caretaker's legitimacy does not rest on the legitimacy of private property. It rests on the legitimacy of social or public property. Thus, if he takes property from one person and gives it to another as a caretaker, he does not contradict his own ideological foundation. Rather, he affirms the supremacy of the different principle of social ownership. Consequently, under democratic conditions, private law, the law of property and contract underlying civil society, disappears as an independent domain of law and is absorbed by an all-encompassing public government-made law, legislation. As the German socialist legal theorist Gustav Radbruch noted, from the perspective of a democratic caretaker, private law is to be regarded only as a provisional and constantly decreasing range of private initiative, temporarily spared within the all-comprehensive sphere of public law. Ultimately, all property is public property. Each established private property right is only provisionally valid and may be altered in accordance with a caretaker's unilateral determination of the requirements of public safety and social security. Second, and more specifically, because caretakers do not own the country's capital stock, the counterproductive effects of income and wealth redistribution are of little or no concern. However, the long-term repercussions of redistributive measures are unimportant to them, while their immediate and short-term effects are not. A caretaker is always under the pressure of political competition from others seeking to replace him. Given the rules of democratic government, of one man, one vote, and majority rule, a caretaker, whether to secure his present position or advance to another, must award or promise to award privileges to groups rather than particular individuals. And given that there always exist more have-nots than haves, of everything worth having, his redistribution will be egalitarian rather than elitist. Accordingly, as the result of democratic competition, the character structure of society will be progressively deformed. For one, regardless of the criteria on which it is based, all redistribution involves taking from an original owner and or producer, the haver of something, and giving to another non-owner and or non-producer, the non-haver of this thing. The incentive to be an original owner or producer of the thing in question is reduced, and the incentive to be a non-owner and non-producer is raised. Consequently, the number of havers and producers declines, and that of non-havers and non-producers rises. And since it is presumably something good that is being redistributed, of which the haver producers have too much and the non-haver non-producers too little, this change implies quite literally that the relative number of bad or not-so-good people and bad or not-so-good personal characteristics and habits will continually rise and life in society will become increasingly less pleasant. Rather than colonization, cultivation and acculturation, democracy will bring about social degeneration, corruption, and decay. Moreover, free competition is not always good. Free competition in the production of goods is good, but free competition in the production of bads is not. Free competition in the torturing and killing of innocents, or free competition in counterfeiting or swindling, for instance, is not good. It is worse than bad. It has already been explained why government, as a compulsory membership organization endowed with the power of ultimate decision-making and taxation, must be considered a bad, at least from a liberal viewpoint. It requires a second look to realize that democratic competition is indeed worse than bad. In every society, as long as mankind is what it is, people who covet another man's property will exist. Some people are more afflicted by this sentiment than others, but people usually learn not to act on such feelings or even feel ashamed for entertaining them. Generally, only a few individuals are unable to successfully suppress their desire for others' property, and they are treated as criminals by their fellow men and repressed by physical punishment. Under princely rule, only one single person, the prince, can possibly act on the desire for another man's property, and it is this which makes him a potential danger and a bad. Apart from the already noted logical and economic disincentives, however, a prince is further restrained in his redistributive desires by the circumstance that all members of society have learned to regard the taking and redistributing of another man's property as shameful and immoral, and accordingly watch your prince's every action with utmost suspicion. In distinct contrast, by freeing up entry into government, everyone is permitted to openly express his desire for other men's property. What was formerly regarded as immoral and accordingly suppressed is now considered a legitimate sentiment. Everyone may openly covet everyone else's property as long as he appeals to democracy, and everyone may act on his desire for another man's property, provided that he finds entrance into government. Hence, under democracy, everyone becomes a threat. Consequently, under democratic conditions, the popular, if immoral and antisocial, desire for other men's property is systematically strengthened. Every demand is legitimate if it is proclaimed publicly under the special protection of freedom of speech. Everything can be said and claimed, and everything is up for grabs. Not even the seemingly most secure private property right is exempt from redistributive demands. Worse, subject to mass elections, those members of society with little or no moral inhibition against taking another man's property, habitual amoralists, who are most talented in assembling majorities from a multitude of morally uninhibited and mutually incompatible popular demands, efficient demagogues, will tend to gain entrance in and rise to the top of government. Hence, a bad situation becomes even worse. Historically, the selection of a prince was through the accident of his noble birth, and his only personal qualification was typically his upbringing as a future prince and preserver of the dynasty and its status and possessions. This did not assure that a prince would not be bad and dangerous, of course. However, it is worth remembering that any prince who failed in his primary duty of preserving the dynasty, who wrecked or ruined the country, caused civil unrest, turmoil and strife, or otherwise endangered the position of the dynasty, faced the immediate risk of either being neutralized or assassinated by another member of his own family. In any case, however, even if the accident of birth and his upbringing could not preclude that a prince might be bad and dangerous, at the same time, the accident of a noble birth and a princely education also did not preclude that he might be a harmless dilettante or even a good and moral person. In contrast, the selection of government rulers by means of popular elections makes it practically impossible that any good or harmless person could ever rise to the top. Prime ministers and presidents are selected for their proven efficiency as morally uninhibited demagogues. Thus, democracy virtually assures that only bad and dangerous men will ever rise to the top of government. Indeed, as the result of free political competition and selection, those who rise will become increasingly bad and dangerous individuals, yet as temporary and interchangeable caretakers, they will only rarely be assassinated. Politicians, notes H.L. Mencken with his characteristic wit, seldom, if ever, get there, into public office, by merit alone, at least in democratic states. Sometimes, to be sure, it happens, but only by a kind of miracle. They are chosen normally for quite different reasons, the chief of which is simply their power to impress and enchant the intellectual underprivileged. Will any of them venture to tell the plain truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about the situation of the country, foreign or domestic? Will any of them refrain from promises that he knows he can't fulfill, that no human being could fulfill? Will any of them utter a word, however obvious, that will alarm and alienate any of the huge pack of morons who cluster at the public trough, walloping in the pap that grows thinner and thinner, hoping against hope? Answer, maybe for a few weeks at the start, but not after the issue is fairly joined and the struggle is on in earnest. They will all promise every man, woman, and child in the country whatever he, she, or it wants. They'll all be roving the land, looking for chances to make the rich poor, to remedy the irremediable, to succor the unsuccorable, to unscramble the unscramblable, to dephlogisticate the undephlogisticable. They will all be curing warts by saying words over them and paying off the national debt with money that no one will have to earn. When one of them demonstrates that twice two is five, another will prove that it is six. 6.5, 10, 20. In brief, they will divest themselves from their character as sensible, candid, and truthful men, and become simply candidates for office bent only on colouring votes. They will all know by then, even supposing that some of them don't know it now, that votes are coloured under democracy, not by talking sense, but by talking nonsense, and they will apply themselves to the job with a hearty yo-heave-ho. Most of them, before the uproar is over, will actually convince themselves. The winner will be whoever promises the most with the least probability of delivering anything. 6. After more than a century of compulsory democracy, the predictable results are before our very eyes. The tax load imposed on property owners and producers makes the economic burden even of slaves and serfs seem moderate in comparison. Government debt has risen to breathtaking heights. Gold has been replaced by government-manufactured paper as money, and its value has continually dwindled. Every detail of private life, property, trade, and contract is regulated by ever higher mountains of paper laws, legislation. In the name of social, public, or national security, our caretakers protect us from global warming and cooling and the extinction of animals and plants, from husbands and wives, parents and employers, poverty, disease, disaster, ignorance, prejudice, racism, sexism, homophobia, and countless other public enemies and dangers. And with enormous stockpiles of weapons of aggression and mass destruction, they defend us, even outside of the US, from ever new Hitlers and all suspected Hitlerite sympathizers. However, the only task a government was ever supposed to assume, of protecting our life and property, our caretakers do not perform. To the contrary, the higher the expenditures on social, public, and national security have risen, the more our private property rights have been eroded, the more our property has been expropriated, confiscated, destroyed, and depreciated, and the more we have been deprived of the very foundation of all protection, of personal independence, economic strength, and private wealth. The more paper laws have been produced, the more legal uncertainty and moral hazard has been created, and lawlessness has displaced law and order. And while we have become ever more helpless, impoverished, threatened, and insecure, our rulers have become increasingly more corrupt, dangerously armed, and arrogant. At this point, the question of the future of liberalism arises. It is appropriate to return to my beginning, to Ludwig von Mises and the idea of liberal social order. Like Etienne Laboutier and David Hume before him, Mises recognized that the power of every government, whether of princes or caretakers, benevolent men or tyrants, rests ultimately on opinion rather than physical force. The agents of government are always only a small proportion of the total population under their control, whether under princely or democratic rule. Even smaller is the proportion of central government agents. But this implies that a government, and in particular a central government, cannot possibly impose its will upon the entire population unless it finds widespread support and voluntary cooperation within the non-governmental public. As Laboutier put it, "He who thus domineers over you has indeed nothing more than the power that you confer upon him to destroy you. Where has he acquired enough eyes to spy upon you if you do not provide them yourselves? How can he have so many arms to beat you with if he does not borrow them from you? The feet that trample down your cities, where does he get them if they are not your own? How does he have any power over you except through you? How would he dare assail you if he had no cooperation from you? What would he do to you if you yourself did not connive with the thief who plunders you, if you were not accomplices of the murderer who kills you, if you were not traitors to yourselves? You sow your crops in order that he may ravage them. You install and furnish your homes to give him goods to pillage. You rear your daughters that he may gratify his lust. You bring up your children in order that he may confer upon them the greatest privilege he knows, to be led into his battles, to be delivered to butchery, to be made the servants of his greed and the instruments of his vengeance. You yield your bodies unto hard labor in order that he may indulge in his delights and wallow in his filthy pleasures. You weaken yourselves in order to make him the stronger and mightier, to hold you in check." End quote. However, if the power of every government rests only on opinion and consensual cooperation, then, as Mises' foremost student and our other intellectual master, Murray N. Rothbard, explained in his introduction to Laboutier's 16th-century treatise, it also follows that each government can be brought down by mere change of opinion and the exercise of sheer willpower. Quote, "For if tyranny really rests on mass consent, then the obvious means for its overthrow is simply mass withdrawal of that consent." End quote. That is, in order to strip government of its powers and repair it to the status of a voluntary membership organization, as before 1861, it is not necessary to take it over, to engage in violent battle against it, or even to lay hands on one's rulers. In fact, to do so would only reaffirm the principle of compulsion and aggressive violence underlying the current system and inevitably lead to the replacement of one government or tyrant by another. To the contrary, it is only necessary that one decide to withdraw from the compulsory union and reassume one's right to self-protection. Indeed, it is essential that one proceed in no other way than by peaceful secession and non-cooperation. Rothbard explains in his introduction to La Boetie, it was a medieval tradition to justify tyrannicide of unjust rulers who break the divine law, but La Boetie's doctrine, though non-violent, was in the deepest sense far more radical. For while the assassination of a tyrant is simply an isolated individual act within an existing political system, mass civil disobedience, being a direct act on the part of large masses of people, is far more revolutionary in launching a transformation of the system itself. It is also more elegant and profound in theoretical terms, flowing immediately, as it does from La Boetie's insight about power necessarily resting on popular consent, for then the remedy to power is simply to withdraw that consent. If this advice seems at first naive, what difference does it make if you or I decide to secede from the Union? Its status as a genuine strategy of social revolution becomes apparent once the full implications of an act of personal secession are spelled out. The decision to secede involves that one regard the central government as illegitimate and that one accordingly treat it and its agents as an outlaw agency and foreign occupying forces. That is, if compelled by them, one complies out of prudence and for no other reason than self-preservation, but one does nothing to support or facilitate their operations. One tries to keep as much of one's property and surrender as little tax money as possible. One considers all federal law, legislation, and regulation null and void, and ignores it whenever possible. One does not work or volunteer for the central government, whether it's executive, legislative, or judicial branch, and one does not associate with anyone who does, and in particular not with those high up in the hierarchy of caretakers. One does not participate in central government politics, and contributes nothing to the operation of the federal political machinery. One does not contribute to any national political party or political campaign, nor to any organization, agency, foundation, institute, or think tank cooperating with or funded by any branch of the federal Leviathan or anyone living or working in or near Washington, D.C. Instead, with as much of one's property as can possibly be secured from the hands of government, one begins to provide for one's own protection and adopts a new systematic twofold investment strategy. On the one hand, just as the existence of private crime requires an appropriate defense, such as locks, guns, gates, guards, and insurance, so the existence of government requires specific defense measures that when invest in such forms and at such locations which withdraw, remove, hide, or conceal one's wealth as far as possible from the eyes and arms of government. But defensive measures are not sufficient. In order to gain full protection of one's property from the reaches of government, it is necessary not to remain isolated in one's decision to secede. Not everyone must follow one's example, of course. Indeed, it is not even necessary that a majority of the entire population do so. It is necessary, however, that at least a majority of the population at many separate localities do so, and to reach this critical level of mass withdrawal, it is essential to complement one's defensive measures with an offensive strategy. To invest in an ideological campaign of delegitimizing the idea and institution of democratic government among the public. The mass of people, as La Boetie and Mises recognized, always and everywhere consists of brutes, dullards, and fools, easily deluded and sunk into habitual submission. Thus today, inundated from early childhood with government propaganda in public schools and educational institutions by legions of publicly certified intellectuals, most people mindlessly accept and repeat nonsense, such as that democracy is self-rule and government is of, by, and for the people. Even if they can see through this deception, most still unquestioningly accept democratic government on account of the fact that it provides them with a multitude of goods and benefits. Such fools, observed La Boetie, do not realize that they are merely recovering a portion of their own property and that their ruler could not have given them what they were receiving without having first taken it from them. Thus, every social revolution will necessarily have to begin with just a few uncommon men, the natural elite. This is how La Boetie describes this elite and its role. There are always a few better endowed than others who feel the weight of the yoke and cannot restrain themselves from attempting to shake it off. These are the men who never become tamed under subjection, and who always, like Ulysses, on land and sea, constantly seeking the smoke of his chimney, cannot prevent themselves from peering about for their natural privileges and from remembering their ancestors and their former ways. These are, in fact, the men who, possessed of clear minds and far-sighted spirit, are not satisfied, like the brutish mass, to see only what is at their feet, but rather look about them, behind and before, and even recall the things of the past in order to judge those of the future and compare both with their present condition. These are the ones who, having good minds of their own, have further trained them by study and learning. Even if liberty had entirely perished from the earth, such men would invent it. For them, slavery has no satisfaction, no matter how well disguised. End quote. Just as there can be no revolution without a liberal, libertarian elite, however, so can there also be no revolution without some form of mass participation. That is, the elite cannot reach its own goal of restoring private property rights and law and order unless it succeeds in communicating its ideas to the public, openly if possible, and secretly if necessary, and awakening the masses from their subservient slumber by arousing at least temporarily their natural instinct of wanting to be free. As Mises put it, the flowering of human society depends on two factors: the intellectual power of outstanding men to conceive sound social and economic theories, and the ability of these or other men to make these ideologies palatable to the majority. End quote. Hence the decision by members of the elite to secede from and not cooperate with government must always include the resolve of engaging in or contributing to a continuous ideological struggle, for if the power of government rests on the widespread acceptance of false, indeed absurd and foolish ideas, then the only genuine protection is the systematic attack of these ideas and the propagation and proliferation of true ones. Yet just as one must always be cautious and careful regarding one's material investments, it is equally important that one be eternally vigilant and selective in one's ideological investments. In particular, in this endeavour, it is not sufficient to merely criticise or support critics and criticisms of specific government policies or personalities. For even if correct and popular, such criticism does not penetrate to the root of the problem. In the terminology of the New Left, it is immanent to the system and thus harmless from the point of view of government. Accordingly, any support given to such efforts, however well-intended, is at best wasteful and at worst further increases the power of government. Rather, while criticisms and critics of government may start with specific policies or personalities, or even if they must do so to attract mass attention, everything and everyone worth supporting will have to go further. Every critic and criticism deserving of support must proceed to explain each and every particular government failing as symptomatic of an underlying flaw in the very idea of government itself, and of democratic government in particular. In other words, no critic or criticism is worthy of anyone's support unless it exposes as intellectual fraud the two pillars on which all government power rests: the belief that the protection of private property, unique among all goods, necessitates a compulsory monopoly, a non-voluntary membership organization, and that private property and protection are best secured if entry into this monopoly of law and order is free and its directors are elected democratically. In fact, there must never be even the slightest wavering in one's commitment to uncompromising ideological radicalism, extremism. Not only would anything less be counterproductive, but more importantly, only radical, indeed radically simple ideas can possibly stir the emotions of the dull and indolent masses. And nothing is more effective in persuading the masses to cease cooperating with government than the constant and relentless exposure, the sanctification and ridicule of government and its representatives as moral and economic frauds and impostors, as emperors without clothes, subject to contempt and the butt of all jokes. If and only if the members of the natural, liberal, libertarian elite have fully grasped this lesson and begin to act accordingly, will liberalism have a future. Only then will they have done what Laboche advised us all to do: resolve to serve no more, and you are at once freed. I do not ask that you place hands upon the tyrant to topple him over, but simply that you support him no longer. Then you will behold him like a great colossus whose pedestal has been pulled away, fall of his own weight, and break into pieces.